This podcast examines issues on violence driven by gender inequality, a profound and widespread global health problem that is likely to have personally touched the lives of our listeners. Listen with care and compassion, and please talk to someone should anything come up for you while listening to this episode. For more resources, email svri@svri.org.
We never get away from our trauma, but we can hold it next to us and keep moving forward in a way. I've seen what can happen to people's lives and feel recovery is possible.
You're listening to the Sexual Violence Research Podcast from the SVRI. I'm Elizabeth Dartnall.
And I am Angelica Pino. Our vision is to see a world free of violence against women and violence against children. And in this podcast, we learn how to make that vision a reality.
In today's episode, we're exploring the issue of mental health and how we can help survivors of sexual violence heal.
We are going to hear from Adesti Dalawan, Clinical Supervisor of World Hope International in the Philippines, a global alliance based in the US, Australia, and Canada. It also has a presence in several countries like Liberia, Sierra Leone, Haiti, Cambodia, and of course, the Philippines.
The organization's focus is on solutions to clean water, energy sector, as well as global health and, of course, child protection. We have been working through relationships with marginalized communities in partnership with key organizations and, of course, the government, and often through social ventures as well. In the Philippines, our work is focused on comprehensive programs that are geared towards strengthening the systems for child protection work through anti-trafficking initiatives and facilitating access to quality education, especially for the marginalized sector. I am a psychologist and I serve as the clinical supervisor. I usually provide training and mentorship to social workers and counselors who are taking care of survivors of online sexual exploitation.
We'll also meet teacher, researcher, and mental health counselor, Abby Fields, who's been working in Nicaragua for more than 30 years.
Most of my research over the past 25 years or so has been focused on sexual violence, initially studying young victims of child sex abuse and approaches to working with them that were effective or not effective. And more recently, I've completed my doctoral work focusing on the recovery processes among adult survivors of child sex abuse. And the main theme that emerged during those years for me was the issue of effectiveness. In as much as we all want the survivors of sexual violence to recover and have good intentions, I think it's very important that we look at the effectiveness of our interventions and whether we're really achieving what we want to achieve.
The mental health impacts of sexual violence, abuse, and exploitation are complex. There's no one-size-fits-all solution, and that's why Abby looks so closely at the effectiveness of our interventions. In order to develop effective methods, we need to fully understand what all survivors are going through.
We often use the diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder to provide a framework to understand the process of trauma in survivors of sexual violence. But as Abby says, that diagnosis doesn't always address the range of issues felt by survivors. So it is important to look at the work of the psychiatrist Judith Herman around complex trauma.
Post-traumatic stress disorder was classification developed by psychologists in the United States in the 80s in response to veterans coming home from the Vietnam War. And then women who worked with sexual violence began to see similarities in some of those symptoms, and PTSD became sort of the go-to for classifying the kinds of experiences that people had post-trauma, like in situations of rape or other types of sexual violence. And to an extent, the diagnosis is accurate. There are many, many people who experience sexual violence who at one point or another will experience the main symptom groups of the post-traumatic stress disorder diagnosis, which is primarily remembering the event either through flashbacks or through nightmares and dreams, avoidance of similar situations and a sort of emotional numbing that can go with it, and hypervigilance, where a person is always on high alert and always sort of overreacting to sensory stimuli because they are in such a heightened state of alert. What Judith Herman introduced to the mix was an understanding that trauma goes way beyond that group of symptoms. And especially in situations where the victim of trauma can't escape from the situation. So this would be typical of children who are being sexually abused, of women who are in situations of violence and abuse, both intimate partner violence and rape and assault. It would also include people who are imprisoned, people who are being tortured. And basically the other dimensions that Herman introduced have to do with the regulation of emotions, which means our ability to control how we respond and feel emotionally, what we call maladaptive coping mechanisms that can include self-injury and substance abuse, changes in attention, memory, consciousness, and that includes dissociative episodes, amnesia, our sense of self and associated feelings with how we feel about ourselves following traumatic experience that can include shame, guilt, and self-blame. A very important area is problems in our interpersonal relationships, and in particular, our ability to trust and be intimate. Those are highly affected by traumatic experience. We can experience a loss of faith or sense of hopelessness. And then there's a whole range of physiological or what we call somatoform symptoms. And that can include physical problems. The women I worked with, almost all of them had problems, gastrointestinal problems, long-term gastrointestinal problems, headaches and migraines. One of the women even had, she was diagnosed as having convulsions, but what she was actually doing was dissociating periodically, and she would be unable to move or talk and sort of fall to the floor. And that went on for her for years. So it can be quite extreme, the kind of physical manifestations.
So how does this broader understanding of complex trauma change the way we respond to and support healing after sexual violence?
A lot. It changes the way we work with people a lot. Because our conceptualization of support and healing after sexual violence is focused on talking about the experience, it's really important to recognize that for a lot of people who are survivors of trauma and survivors of sexual violence, talking about the experience can be extremely painful. And this is because when we're talking about it, we're not remembering an event, we're re-experiencing an event. As a result, many survivors of sexual violence avoid therapy or therapeutic settings because they don't want to talk about it. Understanding complex trauma allows us, first of all, to not see simply, for instance, medicating against the more anxious symptoms that can arise, but understanding that there are different ways to work through the feelings associated with the trauma and get to a place of greater self-knowledge and self-acceptance, which I think is the goal of recovery. There's also a lot of issues related to body image and the feelings we have about our body. So if we understand the complexity of the kinds of feelings that people have, and the fact that these enter into all the realms associated with our sense of who we are and how we feel about ourselves. And if we understand that there's a lot of sensations and feelings associated with trauma, they're not part of a narrative story because of the way trauma is experienced. In a traumatic experience, a lot of times what's happening, what explains the reason why the feelings are not easily acceptable to the part of our brain that we have access to, which is our frontal cortex. During trauma, our whole self-preservation system is being activated. We're an automatic pilot. We're animals in that sense, and our brain is trying to help us survive this terrible experience that we're going through. And as a result of this activation, which involves neurotransmitters and it involves hormones, this heightened state of activation means that the experience is not processed the way just the normal everyday experience is stored in our brain. And so we don't hold it as a narrative story in our frontal cortex, but many of these sensations are instead held in the limbic part of our brain that we can't access. However, when we are engaged with our bodies physically, a lot of those sensations come to the surface. They get stimulated and triggered by the body activation that we're engaged in. And so what the process of engaging the body does is allow us to feel these sensations, even if they're unpleasant, but learn to tolerate them. And as a result, we're able to feel more in control of the way we're interacting with the world around us.
Next, let's look at Adesti's research. She's been exploring the mental health impacts felt by young survivors in the Philippines of online sexual exploitation, referred to as OSEC.
When we speak of online sexual exploitation, first we need to understand that this is a distinct victimization experience. It is unique because, one, it's technology facilitated. It is also usually family perpetuated, unfortunately. And there is grooming involved along the process, thus the survivors do not perceive it as a form of abuse. And it is disheartening that the Philippines has become the epicenter of this phenomenon globally. The effects it has on survivors is still being uncovered, but in the preliminary findings of pilot studies, it was found that one of the first things that usually manifest among survivors are mood disturbances. 2 in 5 children usually indicate suffering from some forms of internalizing symptoms such as withdrawal, anxiety, and loneliness. OSEC survivors usually post higher self-destructive behaviors. They usually have lower self-esteem compared to non-OSEC victims. When they are brought in, you know, like in protective custody, like in residential facilities, they usually come along also with behavioral disturbances because in the initial findings, it was found that the total problem behavior scores in the administered test, usually they have escalated scores, borderline and clinical already. So this is usually manifested through, you know, like aggression, hostility sometimes, withdrawal behaviors. Sexualized behaviors is also noted among OSEC survivors. They manifest disturbed sexual behaviors. And this is primarily because the sexual performances that's done in the abuse experience, it comes along with an antecedent positive reinforcement because the family will get money out of that. And then they are usually reinforced by their parents in doing the sexual performance shows. And thus, it results to distorted views of the child's sex in general and their own sexuality. And then, of course, trauma symptoms is usually present. They post significant trauma scores in the assessments that's being conducted. But when we speak of trauma in OSEC, it's usually multiple layered. In the initial findings, it was found that the actual online sexual exploitation experience per se has slightly lesser trauma effects on the survivors, but rather the child's experiences within the community where the victimization happened. There's also usually other forms of abuses apart from the OSEC, like physical, emotional abuse, and verbal abuse within the homes. So cluster of family violence sometimes. And also the sudden separation from the family due to the rescue efforts. They usually also present attachment difficulties because shame is one of the predominant feelings that they present. Thus, they have usually low levels of self-esteem compared to their peers. They have heightened feelings of isolation, loneliness. And then, of course, we're also dealing with the grooming effects because, again, survivors of OSEC do not perceive OSEC as an abuse. There's denial of abuse. They usually have this misconception that it's just a picture and that their behaviors are actually helpful to their family. So last thing is on the perpetuity of abuse. Knowing that there are permanent images of sexual abuse in the internet may produce re-traumatization for some survivors as they recognize that there will always be a physical record of the abuse in the internet. It is important that service providers are vigilant in looking out for possible emotional, behavioral, and somatic disturbances. World Hope has been working on raising awareness in communities of these indicators of disturbances from possible exploitation or abuse.
ADESTE has also been exploring the experiences of care providers in residential facilities supporting survivors during lockdown.
While many of us have felt feelings of despair, helplessness, and isolation during the pandemic, ADESTE says these feelings have been heightened for those providing care and support for survivors in the Philippines.
Because some of them were confined in these residential facilities, they've been unable to see their families, and some of them have been with the survivors 24/7 during the extended lockdowns. This may possibly lead to burnout or compassion fatigue, among others. So we have been supporting them through check-in sessions, well-being discussion also with them, where they are given tips to better take care of themselves, such as, you know, through meditation, setting boundaries, and also supervision sessions or mentoring session in the implementation of therapy so that they don't get overwhelmed in handling the survivors.
Let's hear more from our guests on the subject of healing now. ADESTE says that tailor-fit interventions in treating trauma-related mental health issues among young survivors of online sexual exploitation and abuse are still being investigated, but research is beginning to uncover some important knowledge.
In the initial findings of the comparative analysis among the interventions that we have been implementing for the survivors, it was found that the narrative modalities or the typical talk therapy has limitations for the OSEC survivors because many of them are still really very young. We have as young as 2 years old, 3 years old. Another thing is that there are factors that affect rapport and disclosures, such as the misconceptions that anything that they say in therapy may incriminate their family members, like their parents who's in jail, and also they have high levels of suspiciousness and mistrust. So what we have found to be more appropriate are the less intrusive modalities such as expressive arts, game-based, play therapy, because it appeals to them better. Their defenses are usually lowered because they are still children. They would still be into the games, into the crayons. Thus, it facilitates stronger rapport. And it leads to better disclosure so that their trauma will be processed. And this is what we are trying to see, whether the study that we are conducting will validate this working theory or not.
How can the findings of these interventions be used to strengthen services for young survivors of online sexual exploitation in the Philippines?
That's really one of the main aims of the study that we are conducting under SVRI. To really make groundbreaking, to have impactful outcomes. So what we're looking at as possible outcomes would be first is on improved awareness and understanding of OSEC. Because this is still an emerging phenomenon. It's the newest form of child trafficking. And many facets of it still really need to be explored. The findings of this study will provide a better clinical picture of the impact of OSEC victimization to survivors. Another thing is that it will strengthen the evidence-based clinical care for OSEC survivors. It will lead into the discovery of what therapeutic interventions would work best for the survivors of OSEC because, again, existing modalities were mostly tailored fit to the traditional forms of sexual abuse, of child sexual abuse. And then the study will find out developmentally appropriate interventions that would address the distinct victimization of the survivors. It will likewise provide perspective on data-driven aftercare programs and in advocating for child protection laws to better protect children from online sexual exploitation.
ADESTE spoke about the importance of play therapy, and there are really interesting parallels between that and Abby's work on a mind-body approach to healing after sexual violence, the subject of her recent work with the SVRI.
We've done some amazing work over the years, and I think that in particular, a lot of the group-focused work with women has been extremely empowering women have found understanding in others of their own situations and felt great validation about the kinds of experiences they've had post-trauma. But for many, many women and other survivors, the trauma has been an ongoing experience. For instance, in the women I worked with in my more recent research, oftentimes survivors are functional. They have jobs, they have relationships, they have children, they have other interests in life professionally and personally. But the sequela of trauma continues to live with them. And so what happens oftentimes is people find themselves in relationships that are floundering and they don't know why, or they're unable to succeed in things and they don't know why. The women I worked with all were educated. They all were employed at the time that we were working together. They had been in and out of relationships. So on a functional level, they were fine, but there was something very deeply and profoundly disturbing in their lives. And when we began to work together, and this was in a trauma-informed yoga program, their lives shifted dramatically. What that meant was things that would come up, get triggered for them automatically without consciousness or awareness, were suddenly coming into view for them. And they were able to calm themselves. They were able to control those feelings in a new way that allowed them to experience relationships in particular with much more gratification. The importance of engaging the body, the best way to understand the importance comes from the fact that a lot of traumatic experience is processed and stored in a way in our brains that doesn't give us access to it. So what we've been discovering in the world of mental health is that the body is the holder of much of this memory, and parts of the brain where we don't have access through conscious awareness is oftentimes the place where these sensations of traumatic experience are stored. And as a result, they can trigger, or they get triggered by experiences or images or by smells or by sounds or by being in places that are reminiscent of where somebody might have been during a traumatic experience. And so what we're finding in the psychological community is that engagement of the body can give us access to sensations that we can't necessarily access through conscious talk. And so a lot of work is going on with the body, not just yoga, which is what I've worked with, but also with other kinds of somatic experiencing, with rapid eye motion, a therapeutic approach called EMDR. And we don't understand completely what's going on in all of these experiences. But what we do see is very convincing results that people are able to access parts of their emotional life through working in the body rather than trying to talk about the experience.
Abby, I just love listening to you and the work that you're doing. And I want to circle back to your study in Nicaragua and the profound impact a trauma-informed yoga program had on the women in your study.
The women I worked with had never really heard of yoga, had never really done anything like that, and were initially a bit skeptical about what we were doing. But basically, these women who were all survivors came together and we practiced with a Hatha yoga teacher one time per week for a period of about 18 weeks. After we would do the yoga practice, the women and I would talk, but not about their sexual abuse histories. We would talk about how the yoga felt to them and what was being stimulated in them and how to make adjustments to the program that might feel more comfortable. So it was based on getting a lot of feedback through the process. I did interviews with the women at the beginning of the program and I did them at the end of the program. And the changes they experienced were phenomenal. They had a reduction in physical symptoms that were associated with the trauma to the point where most of them felt no symptoms at all. Their PTSD symptoms were reduced, particularly hypervigilance and intrusive thoughts and nightmares. All but one were engaged in new intimate relationships. There was no pressure to do so, but this was something that came about in all of their lives. They all referenced the yoga as something that had given them new self-confidence, new dreams in their lives, And it became something that they could use as a tool as well. It wasn't just going to the yoga practice every week, but it was also having the yoga as something they could do at moments when they needed to. So when they were feeling triggered or out of control, they could do some sun salutations, they could go into postures that felt comfortable, and they were able to calm themselves and focus and center. The issue of whether or not to combine yoga or this type of body-focused work with therapy, there's not total agreement about this in the psychological community. My desire was to do yoga as a standalone program. It functioned very effectively as a standalone, but with one caveat, which is that two of the women wanted some psychological support during the program, and it was important to have me, a psychologist, there to be able to provide that support when needed. That meant for one woman who had an encounter with her abuser and wanted to talk about it. I'd also like to add one thing about the yoga, which is not, it's not going into a gym sort of situation and practicing extremely physical yoga, but this is a more, I'll use the word spiritual for lack of another word. The messages of hope, of being centered, of letting go, of taking in, of loving oneself that were part of the practice because of this very wonderful yoga teacher I worked with, those sort of more cognitive messages were a very important component of the physical work. So it was really a true example of the body and mind coming together.
So, are our guests optimistic? Are we making progress on advancing our understanding about which mental health programs work for a diverse range of people?
I personally is very positive in terms of the developments. I mean, there's lots of individuals, organizations, agencies that are invested on better understanding child sexual exploitation and abuse. I remain hopeful that these findings are going to shed light in terms of better understanding abuse and exploitation, and of course, finding out effective interventions that would facilitate the healing and the recovery of the survivors.
I am extremely optimistic, I have to say, after not being optimistic for many years.
I'm so glad.
Through my own work makes me very optimistic. And not only are body-focused interventions much more potentially accessible to people than individualized talk therapy, and it do not require necessarily the level of academic preparation and the kinds of resources, I think it holds great potential in resource challenge settings, as long as it's done in a way that is mindful of what the needs of people are. There's also incredible experimentation going on with drugs that were previously excluded from research, drugs such as MDMA and other psychedelics, which when used in conjunction with psychologists who are guiding their use, have shown dramatic improvements in trauma symptoms. So I feel extremely optimistic that we have more tools that are more effective and helping people live fuller and richer lives. We never get away from our trauma, but we can, rather than it sitting on top of our head, we can hold it next to us and keep moving forward in a way. The women I worked with were so, so impacted by this experience. And I've seen what can happen to people's lives and feel incredibly hopeful that recovery is possible. A young woman named Juanita said at the end of this trauma program that I did, "I was looking for the key and I think I found it. I no longer feel the same weight or the same emotion, the same guilt. I feel completely calm, relaxed, safe. There is something that happened and now I can see it. Yes, I think the yoga has had a lot to do with my healing process, because if not, it wouldn't have been possible for me to connect with myself or understand others, because I feel like everything was shut down. Everything was deafened because you're so stuck in the pain." And Juanita went on to continue living her life and with just new hope for the future. That's what makes me so optimistic.
Thanks to our guests, Adesti Duluan and Abby Fields, for joining us on the podcast. I'm Elizabeth Dartnell,
And I am Angelica Pino. You have been listening to the Sexual Violence Research Podcast by the SVRI. To find out more about our vision, visit svri.org.
To free the world of violence against women and violence against children, we need everyone to hear our message. So please subscribe, like, and review us on Apple Podcasts and share this episode far and wide.
Thanks for listening, and we will see you for episode 6, which tackles the subject of engaging faith and spiritual leaders in addressing gender-based violence.
This podcast is produced by OG Podcasts. Find out more at ogpodcasts.co.uk.